From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Anki Tikrutha.
And I'm Clara Izupides.
This week on War News Radio, the cost of conflict. First, we hear from experts about the recent attack on the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul and the possible repercussions it could have for American troops in Afghanistan.
Then, in an extended report, we learn about the development of human trafficking in post-war Iraq.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The Taliban has increased attacks along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, striking several Afghan border police posts in the northeastern province of Nuristan. According to the province's governor, Jamaldeen Badr, 23 border policemen were killed and 7 more were wounded. In addition, Brigadier General Aminullah Amar Khal says more than 40 Taliban militants were killed during intense fighting. Afghan President Hamid Karzai condemned the attacks, claiming that the Pakistani Taliban were responsible.
White House officials are planning to keep up to 10,000 troops in Iraq beyond the previous U.S. deadline for withdrawal in December. The extension depends on a formal request from the Iraqi government, which is currently divided on the issue. The Kurdistan Parliament Speaker, Kamal Kirkuki, has publicly said that growing violence in Iraq shows that they are not ready for the U.S. to withdraw at the end of the year. However, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party, the Islamic Dawah Party, released a statement in mid-June saying that the United States should honor their agreement to leave at the end of 2011. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney has said that the U.S. plans to stay on schedule, but would consider a request from Iraq to stay longer.
Violence in Iraq increased this week, with several attacks across the country. A car bomb and roadside bombing in Taji, north of Baghdad, killed at least 35 people and wounded 47. A suicide bombing at a car dealership in Bakuba killed 2 and injured 20. A roadside bomb detonated 20 kilometers from Abu Ghraib, killing one soldier and injuring another. Also in the Abu Ghraib area, 2 sticky bombs detonated in separate incidents. One, attached to a civilian car, killed its driver. Another seriously injured Mohsen al-Amri, deputy head of Abu Ghraib's town council. 2 rockets exploded at Al-Butira military airport in Amara, south of Baghdad, though no damage occurred. Due to the recent increase in violence, there is concern whether Iraq will erupt in more conflict should the U.S. withdraw as currently planned. Iraqi official sources say the June death toll was 271, the highest since early 2011.
Iraqi officials discovered 900 bodies buried in Diwaniyah, the capital city of Al-Qadisiyya province. The bodies are believed to be those of Kurds killed in the 1980s during the reign of the Saddam Hussein regime. Some of the bodies have been transferred to forensics laboratories for identification by judicial teams of the Iraqi Human Rights Ministry. The burial site joins the 263 other mass graves discovered from Saddam Hussein's rule since the 2003 Iraq invasion.
Earlier this week, Libyan rebels seized a strategically important town in the western Nafusa Mountains. The rebels took control of Al-Qawalish, just 50 kilometers from Garyan, one of the towns used to supply Gaddafi forces, and the last town in the Nafusa range. The rebels hoped to take control of Garyan and eventually seize the Libyan capital of Tripoli. While rebels in Misrata have stated difficulties in taking Tripoli due to a lack of ammunition, they have also said that they are progressing toward Garyan slowly and with caution in order to avoid civilian casualties.
A Somali terrorism suspect, who faced secret military questioning for 2 months aboard a U.S. Navy ship, was flown to New York to face a federal indictment earlier this week. On April 19th, Ahmed Warsami was captured by U.S. military forces in the Gulf of Aden, suspected of involvement with the militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab, as well as the Yemen-based branch of Al-Qaeda. Because he was detained without being charged or having access to legal representation, his case is raising questions about the manner in which the Obama administration is handling its counterterrorism operations. By transporting Warsami to New York before announcing his capture, the military avoided congressional restrictions that prevent other detainees, such as those from Guantanamo Bay, from being brought into the country. Warsami currently faces 9 counts, which include conspiracy and providing material support to terrorist organizations.
War News Radio. At the end of June, President Obama announced that the United States would start to withdraw from Afghanistan, beginning with the 33,000 surplus troops. Shortly after this announcement, Taliban insurgents laid siege to the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, a hotel popular with international travelers and leading politicians. In light of these events, many doubt the capabilities of the Afghan government to maintain security, as well as President Obama's assurance that Kabul is safer and that Afghan security forces are better prepared. War News Radio's Sarah Dwyer spoke with experts about the significance of the attack.
A week after Taliban militants attacked the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, killing 11 civilians and wounding at least a dozen more, experts disagree on the possible role played by President Obama's recent announcement of a troop drawback. The U.S. is planning to withdraw 10,000 troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year and 23,000 more by the summer of 2012. Ahmed Lameh is a news anchor from the Afghan news channel Tolo News. Working out of Kabul at the time of the attack on the Intercontinental, he provided War News Radio with an account of the violence.
I was 5 kilometers away from the building, and I was able to see the firings and hearing the sounds of explosions. And I thought there is a massive, a very serious attack on the hotel.
Lame says it was not clear who was in the hotel, but that he had information that dozens of provincial governors were there for a meeting, which was scheduled for the next day.
They were in Kabul to discuss how to take over for security in the province, which is scheduled to be over by 2014. And the militants wanted to assassinate the governors. Fortunately, they couldn't reach the governors.
Because the attack took place so soon after President Obama announced the drawdown of American forces, and because it targeted a meeting of Afghan governors planning for this transition, many, like Lameh, believe it was a direct reaction to the president's announcement.
It happened, the Intercontinental Hotel attack happens just the U.S. President Barack Obama announced the drawdown of its troops from Afghanistan. At the same time, the militants trying to prove that they are powerful and they can do whatever they want, even in the capital, even in the places where there is many security forces, there are foreign guests. This is a very big ultimatum to the Afghan officials, to the commitments that they have made, that they will take over for own security starting in mid-July.
However, Professor Kyron Skinner, director of the Center for International Relations and Politics at Carnegie Mellon University and a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, believes that this attack is not directly linked to the president's announcement. Instead, she sees it as part of a larger pattern of violence.
The attack at the Intercontinental Hotel in Afghanistan is part of a number of attacks that have been taking place in recent years by insurgents in the country, so it's not unique in that way. It has happened before. It's a sad story that continues. I don't think it is unique to the announcement by President Obama of a few days ago that the United States would draw down the 33,000 surge troops that he put in place the first year in office. So it's part of a larger pattern of violence by a violent extremist organization.
Matthew Akins, a freelance journalist working out of Afghanistan for Harper's Magazine, echoes Professor Skinner's belief that this attack represents a continuation of violence in Afghanistan.
This attack is not really out of character for what the Taliban has done in the past. It had multiple coordinated assaults by suicide bombers on a hotel before, for example, what happened at the Serena. And there was an attack by 3 suicide bombers on a police station in Central Kabul at the end of June. So, not really out of the ordinary.
According to Akins, this attack was a little more unusual because of its high-profile target. Typically, insurgents in Afghanistan choose soft targets.
relatively lightly defended locations that are really civilian targets, such as the suicide bomber who blew himself up in the finest supermarket and just massacred a bunch of people who were in there shopping. What was most unusual about the attack, though, I guess, is just the cinematic quality of it.
However, whether the attack was a direct challenge to the new role of the Afghan government in national security or part of trending violence in Afghanistan, it highlights a lack of confidence in Afghan security forces and the difficulty that lies ahead as the United States begins to transfer responsibility in Afghanistan.
There's not really much evidence that the Afghan security forces are ready to take over security on their own, either in general or in the sort of specific areas that are scheduled to be first in transition.
According to Akins, part of this is because Afghan forces have not yet been given a chance to take on full responsibility for security.
But at the same time, from the limited examples that we've seen, the Afghan security forces have gotten into quite a lot of trouble when they've sort of been left to their own devices. And the initial signs, for example, in the South aren't particularly encouraging.
Professor Skinner agrees that Afghanistan is not ready to take over full sovereign authority.
Everything from military to security and police forces to civil society, political institutions, governance, the whole gamut. The Afghan leadership needs a lot of help. There's corruption there within the governing structure. That's one problem.
Skinner adds that another problem is that the Taliban itself has remained difficult to root out, despite U.S. military advances.
The planned exit makes sense from a Western standpoint, from the standpoint of our domestic audience in the United States, and for those ISAF countries that are also beginning to draw down. But it's a very weak regime with an insurgency that cannot easily be quelled, that has safe houses in Pakistan. This is a very difficult scenario.
Despite these concerns, the United States plans to continue the drawdown with hopes to end combat operations in Afghanistan, effectively bringing an end to their role in the conflict by 2014. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Dwider.
This is War News Radio. Modern-day slavery is defined by the United Nations to be one person controlling another by the use of violence or the threat of violence, exploiting them economically and paying them nothing. While this might seem remote for many of us, for more than 50,000 Iraqi women and girls, some as young as 10, it is merely their everyday reality. War News Radio's Dina Sherhan reports on the explosion of human trafficking in the war-torn country.
Human trafficking, that is a process by which someone is placed into the situation of slavery, diminished greatly in the 19th century and almost completely disappeared in the 20th century in Iraq. The 2003 war, however, shook the fabric of the Iraqi society, wiping away a great deal of the rule of law and infrastructure. Now, 9 years after the war, is human trafficking once again a major problem in Iraq?
One of the results of this war was a full army of devastated young women who were sold as commodities and whose lives had been destroyed.
That was Yanar Mohammed, the head of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, also known as OFI.
In a Middle Eastern society, once you've been prostituted, there's almost no way that you could blend into the mainstream society anymore. The women of Iraq may not be better off under this occupation because authorities or the forces of occupation did not think it was their responsibility to even care for the issue.
OFI, which was established in 2003 in Baghdad, works with and offers shelter to Iraqi women and girls who have been exploited for labor and sex, both nationally and internationally. Mohammed believes that human trafficking is one of the many side effects of the 2003 war that civilians have had to endure, since human trafficking was not at all apparent during the Ba'ath regime.
We would never hear of an issue of trafficking. We didn't even know what the word meant. This was before the war on Iraq, but after the war, new authorities came into place and some measures began to take place without having any drafted law that supported them.
Mohammed says the new authorities were mostly fundamentalist religious groups who were in control of the Ministry of Interior, including police and intelligence.
Some of those groups or individuals, they acted like self-acclaimed vigilantes who would go around the streets and who would feel free to kill women if they suspected that they were in prostitution.
Professor Bridget Carr is the director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School and has been working directly with young Iraqi girls who had been trafficked within Iraq and resettled in the U.S. by the United Nations. She explains factors that could have contributed to the development of human trafficking in Iraq.
Human trafficking is prevalent worldwide, whether there is conflict, post-conflict, or no conflict. And so I think what we see in conflict and post-conflict zones are just the vulnerabilities of people are even heightened.
Carr believes that when people are vulnerable, traffickers will step in. Also, she says in conflict and post-conflict zones, law enforcement and government officials often don't have the power or authority in which to try and stop that kind of exploitation.
Trafficking in Iraq has so many commonalities with what we see happening in the United States and Mexico and other places, in that it is vulnerable people who are often on the margins of society and who are exploited for profit.
Dr. Kevin Bales, an expert on modern slavery and president of Free the Slaves, explains that human trafficking is not a new industry in conflict and post-conflict zones. Instead, it is a phenomenon that has had a long historical presence in human civilization.
The relationship between slavery and trafficking and conflict is just about the oldest set of criminal factors that come together in human history.
According to Bales, in the Tigris and Euphrates area, now in Iraq, and at the very beginning of human written records, people in conflict were often affected by slavery.
So the crucial thing here is that anytime you have conflict which causes the collapse of the rule of law, it means that people using force to take control of other people's lives. And it kind of unleashes a lawlessness and a ubiquity of force that means slavery tends to erupt almost every time there is a conflict.
Bales further explains how the collapse of the rules of law in post-war Iraq has greatly exacerbated human trafficking.
Obviously, under Saddam Hussein, the rule of law was not what you would call a perfectly straight and balanced and just rule of law, but it was a very strict rule of law.
Bales says that the strict rule of law under Hussein then prevented some human rights violations. When Hussein's regime collapsed and the rule of law disappeared, slavery and trafficking emerged.
A war that involves the destruction of infrastructure physically, but also the destruction of the kind of conceptual and juridical and policy and governmental infrastructures. And it's not surprising at that point that you begin to see criminals emerging and taking advantage of that chaos.
Although statistics released by OFI show that 50,000 Iraqi females have been trafficked since the outbreak of the war, Mohammed thinks that the actual figures are much higher. She says many kidnapping cases go unreported in Iraq due to the shame that such an incident could bring to the victims and their families.
But in my assumption, that number is very conservative. The real numbers are much more. Daughters kidnapped or who disappeared. This is one of the biggest strikes of shame that could hit an Iraqi family. So they would just tell the neighbors that she died without giving any details.
Mohammed offers a cultural explanation for this notion of shame caused by the disappearance of one's daughter.
In a Middle Eastern society, and especially in Iraq, a woman who had left her house for more than 24 hours would most probably expect to be slain when she goes back there.
Mohammed during her years working with trafficked women and girls, observed that, while trafficking is random and could happen to anyone in any Iraqi city, there have been a few common trends that emerged in post-war Iraq.
Cases that we found, either the families are very poor, family had to sell one of their daughters into something called marriage so as the rest of their children can survive, or that the girls are kidnapped and seduced by love by men who were recruited by traffickers.
Mohammed explains that trafficking of those young Iraqi girls became an industry because the consumers were asking for more and more of it.
In some of the cases, the girls were kidnapped as virgins, and we could trace a few cases that were trafficked all the way to the Arab Emirates, specifically to a very thriving market in Abu Dhabi, where they would be sold for high prices, if $10,000 is a high price for a teenage girl.
Bales talks in detail about forced marriage, a prominent cultural trend in Iraq that has been classified by the UN as a form of human trafficking.
What we're lacking when it comes to forced marriage is a really clear understanding. I mean, we can certainly point to individual cases in Iraq and other countries where we're saying, look, here's a 15-year-old girl. Someone has basically taken away all possibility of choice on her part and said, she must go with this man.
Forced marriage then entails a complete control of one person on another, the family and the designated groom over the bride-to-be. If she tries to get away, violence is usually used to make her stay. According to Bales, those are the hallmarks of slavery.
The only trouble that we have in terms of understanding it is that many countries, and particularly countries in the Middle East, are very hesitant about investigating the nature of forced marriage within their culture.
Mohammed has also noticed that the orphans and widows of war have fueled the industry of human trafficking. She believes that the reason why the orphans and widows are even more vulnerable to human trafficking is because the Ministry of Social Affairs has not been adequately addressing their needs.
The Ministry of Social Affairs does not give much offer for the widows of the war. They would give one widow who has one child something equivalent to, say, $75 a month. That is if she has her full papers and her IDs and everything is in place and she had access to the right officials. And through our experience, we found out that most of the designated salaries of widows were going to some official's pocket.
After the break, in the second segment of this report, Dina Sherhan will take a look into the validity of the mechanisms employed to fight human trafficking in Iraq.
This is War News Radio. Despite the efforts of many non-governmental organizations fighting human trafficking in post-war Iraq, the crisis has only been thriving. Who is responsible for this horrific crime in the war-torn country? Dina Sherhan continues to look into this matter.
Yanar Mohammed says that the lack of anti-trafficking laws in Iraq is causing the government to take extraordinary measures in dealing with female victims.
In 2005, we went into the prisons of women, which were open to us, and that is the Central Prison of Women in Kadamiya. We were surprised to find that even more than half the inmates in the prison were there because of either being prostituted or being trafficked across the country and caught while being trafficked.
According to Mohammed, prostitution in Iraq is illegal. Since there is no anti-trafficking law that would address this new issue, a woman who has been trafficked could be convicted of prostitution.
So we found a good number of very young women who were held under the verdict of prostitution just because she was trafficked.
Mohammed claims that despite their demand, members of her organization have not received any help from parties in question.
We were contacted by the IOM. They should be taking care of issues of trafficking. They asked for our information, and I gave them the report that we have and provided them with answers to all their questions.
Mohammed and her colleagues received no response at all, she says, other than a very negative one.
We did not hear anything from them. We did not hear anything from the U.S. government. We were badmouthed by the Iraqi government.
Bales predicted the weak response from the authorities in Iraq to human trafficking. This is because of the ongoing need to restore justice and rebuild the war-torn country's formal economy.
In the history of global diplomacy, human trafficking and contemporary forms of slavery take a back seat to almost any other issue. So that if you look to what countries are doing and saying, you'll see that they may talk okay about contemporary slavery, but they don't necessarily take the actions or put the resources there.
Bales says that there are many resources going into Iraq from different places devoted to many other needs. He thinks, however, that most of these resources don't actually confront the problems of slavery and trafficking.
It's a hidden crime at the best of times, and when you have a certain amount of unrest and confusion, it's even easier to hide a crime like human trafficking and contemporary slavery.
Everyone we talked with agreed that there remains much work to be done to combat human trafficking in Iraq. Professor Carr summarizes her views.
Iraq hasn't met the minimum standards for human trafficking law as laid out by the U.S. State Department. They do have a plan in place, but the legislature hasn't passed the law that that plan describes, partially because the legislature hasn't met all that much.
She believes that getting the bare minimum legal requirements in place in the Iraqi system is necessary. She also has many other ideas, including
putting forth an awareness campaign within the country. And then finally, but you know, this is something many countries struggle with, trying to figure out the best way to identify victims and treat them as victims and not as criminals or other things, because fighting human trafficking, it takes both prevention and identification of victims.
OFI, like other NGOs, has helped dozens of survivors forget about their past, heal, and move forward. However, they cannot meet every demand, including the difficulty in addressing the victim's medical and psychological needs, their addictions, and other related effects of the traumatic experience. Visit our site in the future to listen to stories of survivors of human trafficking, as told by Yanar Mohammed. For World News Radio, I'm Dina Sherhan.
Show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Eliana Biscard Church, Stuart Russell, and Dina Sherhan. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Anki Tikrutha.
And I'm Clara Izupitis. Until next time, thanks for listening.